Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
It is our most read story on the Bloomberg today. Elon on Twitter. Elon Musk, not just a prolific user of it, not just the biggest individual shareholder of Twitter shares. He is now the world's richest person who now wants to acquire it. $43 billion, $54.20 a share. But, you know, investors just not sure it's going to happen. And I got to say, Elon not sure it's going to happen either. Check it out.
Civilizational risk is decreased if Twitter, the more we can increase the trust of Twitter as a public platform. And so I do think this will be somewhat painful, and I'm not sure that I will actually be able to acquire it.
All right. That, of course, Elon Musk speaking at a TED event in Vancouver. Let's get to it. We've got a great roundtable.
Ed Ludlow is West Coast correspondent for Bloomberg News. He's from our Bloomberg 960 studio right now in San Francisco. Mandeep Singh is senior tech industry analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us now on the phone from Long Island, New York. Ed, I want to start with you because plenty of headlines that we got just now from Vancouver, where Elon Musk was talking with Chris Anderson from TED. Plan B, if he's not able to pull it off this time around. He didn't elaborate on it, but what could that mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of hypotheses out there in the market today about how he would finance a deal to buy Twitter or take Twitter private. And, you know, the biggest clue in there was that he basically pledged that he would retain as many shareholders as is legal for a private company. And he said he thought that that would be around 200 shareholders or investors, you know, and he has different routes. You know, you look at Tesla stock, for example, under pressure today. One hypothesis is that he could sell some of his Tesla holdings to fund that deal. The other is that he could borrow against the value because, of course, world's richest man, a lot of his net worth is tied to that equity in Tesla. And the third bucket, which kind of speaks to what I was just saying about, in, you know, other shareholders, maybe he puts together a consortium. But as you said, we have no idea what plan B is. It keeps us guessing.
I want to bring in Mandeep Singh now from Bloomberg Intelligence, because Mandeep, as soon as this news crossed, I thought of you because you kind of called this last week. You said, watch what happens when Elon Musk potentially wants to acquire more of this company. To Ed's point, the third one, a group of investors, perhaps. Silver Lake was a name that you threw around last week. Do you think he could actually pull this off without using all of his, without using a good portion of his own money?
I think it's becoming increasingly unlikely, given, you know, the board didn't acknowledge the offer, and we don't know, you know, who the other investors will be. If he's talking about, you know, close to 100 investors, it's very hard to imagine, you know, who will support him to run the company, you know, if at all he ends up running Twitter as well. So a lot of questions. And I think, you know, he would have done it if there were just his money and probably Silver Lake or someone else. But if we're talking about more shareholders, that's where he may have a problem there.
All right, guys. This is the man who gets a factory built for Tesla manufacturing in record time. It is so difficult to do that. And we know when he wants to get something done, he gets it done. Mandeep, this feels tortured, this process. I don't know. How are we supposed to observe? Certainly investors are kind of definitely doing a rethink about whether or not this will ultimately even happen. How do you see it more bigger picture?
I think the bigger picture here is he has really created a lot of interest in Twitter, the company, the social media network. And look, all the social media companies are valued on engagement and user growth. And what this will end up doing is essentially catalyze user growth for Twitter. I do think it will reflect in the numbers going forward. What the current management was doing was working on a plan to, you know, boost shareholder value, top line growth. But this just kind of gives a short in the arm in terms of, you know, helping catalyze that interest in the company. And like I said, engagement is the key for any social network. Guess what? Facebook's engagement is going down. This will certainly help Twitter in terms of engagement.
I feel like every deal team should be like thinking, okay, let me talk to the deal makers on Wall Street. And like, are they now like looking at Twitter at this point? Ed, come on in on the same question, because I'm just trying to understand the end game here. This is a very smart man. When he wants to do something, he just does it.
Yeah, he has this motto that everything needs to be kind of logical, and that it should just have a result. You know, that if there's a problem, find a solution. You know, everything that he discussed, and to Mandeep's point, you know, what you're trying to do is understand the rationale behind this. And the only consistent thing over the last 2 weeks or so, across the regulatory filings, across his tweets, across what he said in the TED Talks, is freedom of speech. And you look at the proposals that he's making for changes to the Twitter platform, they are basically threefold, right? Open sourcing the algorithm, removing bots from the platform, and proposing an edit button where there's a time limitation on making those edits. But what he kept going back through was this kind of big picture idea that he believes in freedom of speech, and that given Twitter's scale globally, it was crucially important for the United States as a Western free country that he did this. That is the rationale behind his action.
All right, let's get back to talking about Elon Musk, his offer $43 billion in cash to take Twitter private. Still with us, Ed Ludlow, West Coast correspondent at Bloomberg News in our 960 studio in San Francisco. Mandeep Singh is senior technology industry analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. He's on the phone from Long Island City. You had a question.
I have lots of questions. Ed, I want to start with you. Does this mean, if let's say Elon Musk is able to take over Twitter, and this involves a little bit of prognostication here, okay? Does that mean that President Trump gets back on Twitter right away?
You know, it's interesting. I've been asked this question all day long. All we can say is what we know based on past precedent, right? That Elon Musk had a more direct and engaged relationship with President Trump than he does with the current administration. You know, Musk has kind of passively called out President Biden and the White House on Twitter. I've joked with you guys before, but when Biden tweets about GM and Ford and their success in electrification, Musk has often replied saying TESLA, Tesla, you know, just with those tweets. I mean, this is my question for Mandeep, that he has covered Twitter so well. And over the last few years in the pandemic era, we've learned how event-driven the growth narrative is for Twitter. But this kind of changes the game, right? Where, like Instagram, where celebrities, people with status, profile, you know, influencers have such power on those platforms, I now wonder just how crucial and closely tied the fates are of Twitter and Elon Musk. And you wonder the role the administration does play in all of this. It's really tough to unpick.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Elon Musk has such a big following that if anything, it helps draw more younger users on the platform. The fact that, you know, he is so engaging, you know, with his day-to-day tweets. And now if he's talking about changing the platform and how he can advocate free speech, I think all in all these are positives. The only risk is that if this gets drawn out, then it will be bad for employee morale. And, you know, that's mm-hmm. where Twitter is at risk of losing talent. And the longer this goes, the drama goes, I think that's where, you know, you kind of take the other side of it.
If it gets drawn out, it would be bad for my sleep cycles as well, because I can't deal with these early morning regulatory filings. Sorry to interrupt, guys.
Yeah. And Elon tweets at all hours. By the way, number of followers, 81,736,467. Just a few more than certainly I have. Hey, guys, what do you make of him wanting to take it private? And we are in an environment where companies can easily go private. There's lots of money out there chasing deals. This would be a massive deal. Ed, what do you make of that? And what that would enable Elon to do.
Yeah, I would stick to the reporting on this. You know, I spent all morning studying the regulatory filing and the letter from Elon Musk to Twitter's board. And ultimately, in that communication, he says that the changes that he feels are necessary to improve Twitter's platform can only be done if the company is taken private. That's his wording in that regulatory filing. And he also said, bearing in mind, this is his final offer, and there will be no quote back and forth. Well, let's see if that happens. But it does seem like an ultimatum, right? Private or nothing.
I'm just going to say, this is the man who puts out forecasts and then doesn't hit them.
And investors are sometimes cool with that. Yeah. Final offer, but there is a plan B. So Mandeep, you did mention that you don't think that this deal... you talked about the veracity of the deal here. But I'm wondering what you think happens next and what we need to be watching for. What could be a plan B? And does Elon Musk raise the price?
Well, so if Elon was to buy the company with a group of investors, I think it'll be a very exclusive small group. But the question is, who leads the company, and who will run the company? And I think that is where the key lies, because if the board turns down the offer, then I do think they will probably have somebody else step up into the management role. We know Elon Musk didn't like the way the company is being run right now. He's not getting along with the management team. So clearly somebody from the board either has to step up and drive that management change. I think the chairman, Bret Taylor, is in the best position. And that is the key for me to watch out for. I can't say about plan B. I think he could sell his stake, but it's a far-fetched scenario at this point of time.
Because I feel like the big question here is, how many times have we all talked about figuring out, we all understand Twitter, understand its value, and yet in terms of monetization, it's still kind of tricky, and it feels like management team after management team still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, the evolution of the product too. It's very similar to what it was 15 years ago, 12 years ago.
All right. Our thanks to Ed Ludlow, West Coast correspondent at Bloomberg News, and Mandeep Singh, senior tech industry analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
It's the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It is out on newsstands, online, on the Bloomberg. And the cover story is about the newly electrified version of the Ford F-150 truck as the auto giant looks to re-engineer the 40-year smash success of its gas-powered version. This model has been so important to Ford.
It has, and truly, pretty much the most important thing in about 100 years, according to Ford executives. Keith Naughton is the person who wrote that story. He's auto reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Detroit. Keith, I have one very simple question just to get out of the way in the beginning. A frunk. Who would have thought that a frunk would be such a selling point for this vehicle? Please explain.
And not just a frunk, but a mega power frunk, just to be clear.
Okay, thank you,
As we say in the story, Ford went all Texas on it, and they have this 13 cubic foot gaping maw that you can put two sets of golf clubs in. It literally has a built-in ice chest with a drain so that you can do something called front gating. As Ford's top marketing executive said, you can have a party on both ends.
All right. Joel Weber is with us, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Do you have a frunk, Joel?
I think he does, actually.
Joel there?
You do have a frunk, right, Joel?
I do have a frunk, I have a Tesla, so I'll admit that I do have a frunk. It might not be as large as the one that's going to be in the F-150. And, when Keith and I first started talking about this story, I think this is we talk about business strategy stories a lot at Business Week. This is like a textbook one, right? Tesla has proven over a decade now that the future is going to be electric vehicles, and now comes the rest of the world trying to play catch up to that idea, and along comes Ford with basically the best selling vehicle in America. Americans love trucks. There's no truck they love more than the F-150. The F-150 is like an economy all by itself. And now comes the time, the moment where Ford's going to bet the house and electrify that flagship iconic product, right? So it's about the frunk. The front's cute, but oh my God, it is so much bigger than the frunk, right, Keith? And the stakes absolutely for this thing couldn't be any higher for Ford.
Right. Jim Farley, the CEO, called this a bet the company moment. He said, "Does this keep us up at night? You betcha. Because this is the ball game. Because Americans don't really, despite Tesla's success, Americans don't really buy electric vehicles. Only about 3% of U.S. sales were electric vehicles last year. The rate is much higher in Europe and very high in China. But this is the one that could change that, because it is the ultimate mainstream vehicle. If Ford can convince particularly traditional truckers to embrace electrification, then it goes mainstream.
Is it fair, Keith, at this point, is it too early to call it a success? I mean, the pre-orders are pretty much off the charts, and what Ford had to do in order to accommodate that in terms of production.
Yeah, they really weren't prepared for the success of this truck. They introduced it last May in this very flashy ceremony in front of Ford's world headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan, and then immediately just the reservations were just off the charts. So they reached almost 200,000 before Ford had to stop taking them. They have doubled factory capacity twice. They originally planned to build 40,000 a year. Now they have the capability to build 150,000 a year. And let's not forget, they got a big PR push from President Biden, who drove the truck, floored it on the recommendation of the CEO.
Love
he
it.
Said, "Mash the throttle," and then when Joe got done, he said, "This sucker's quick."
So you've got a huge PR win, organic PR that comes from the president of the United States doing that. The other thing that, you know, Keith, that really is going to be, I think, a PR advantage is the fact that they're rolling this thing out effectively at scale, right? And how does that compare to the rest of the electric truck kind of category, right? Because really what Ford is going for here is not only is it the flagship category, but like how much of the electric truck category can it seize?
Right. Ford really has essentially a first mover advantage here. Instead of like building a brand new electric truck from the ground up, they went back and they kind of retrofitted the existing F-150. The cab, the shape, the design, it will all look very familiar, but that's part of the strategy. They want to keep it familiar so these traditionalists will buy into it. And the only other trucks on the market right now are the relatively low-selling Rivian R1T from the startup Rivian, which starts at around $80,000 a year, or $80,000 rather, I should say. And then GM has its new electric Hummer out, and that's a six-figure truck. So those are small volume trucks. Ford's truck starts just below $40,000. It's basically in the same price range as a regular gas-fired truck. So they're really going for high volume. And, you know, the Chevy Silverado, which is one of its primary competitors, is still a year out. Tesla's Cybertruck, that's gotten so much buzz and was actually introduced before the Ford F-150 Lightning, that's still a year away. And we don't even know when the Ram is coming, which is the other big selling pickup truck in the United States. So Ford has sort of open road ahead of itself to sort of seize the market.
Yeah, some more teases from Elon about the Cybertruck just over the last week or so. Hey, you know, Keith, in your story, you write that the people who are queuing up for the Lightning, they're buyers who are new to pickups or new to Ford. So at the risk, I mean, is Ford at risk of kind of losing the old guard in this, you know, in terms of the folks who used to love the F-150 before the electric model? Are they at risk of losing them? And if so, does it matter?
It definitely matters, because those old guard buyers buy almost 900,000 F-series pickups a year. That's the franchise for Ford. That's that's what funds their existence and is funding their electric future. And convincing those traditionalists is sort of the marketing challenge of the century. You're right. The first ones who are reserving this truck are not the traditional F-150 buyers. They're first movers. They're the sort of coastal elites who never gave, you know, Ford or any American automaker not named Tesla a second look. But what Ford is trying to do is win over these traditionalists, who are, by the way, the demographics show, in their late 70s, white males, conservative. They're not interested in climate change. So what Ford is trying to do is focus on other things, like the frunk, or like the fact that this truck can also power your home in a blackout for several days. You know, these features that you could only get on an electric truck. It has incredibly fast speed, 0 to 60 in 4.3 seconds, like a sports car.
Right.
So they're focusing on these things in order to win over that old guard.
Wow, it's incredible. Oh, go ahead. What were you going to say, Joel?
Oh, no, I think that is exactly right. It's like, how do you maintain what you got, but pay it forward into the future? And that's going to be the challenge for Ford.
Yeah, it's the balance for all these guys, right? All right, got to run. Thank you so much. Joel Weber, of course, editor of Business Week, and Keith Naughton, auto reporter at Bloomberg News. It is the cover of the new issue of Business Week. And you are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
As we mentioned, we've been talking all week about the New York International Auto Show being back after a two-year absence because of the pandemic. And our weekend radio show and podcast, by the way, features several auto-related interviews, including the CEO of Lamborghini and then Maiko Muzio over at Cox Automotive and Kelly Blue Book, who actually walked the show. You know who else is walking the show?
Yelena Shulyateva. She's senior U.S. economist for Bloomberg Economics. She joins us on the phone from Convention Center here in New York City. Yelena, what is it like there after a two-year hiatus? People wearing masks. What's going on?
Oh, my God. It's such a blast. You know, finally, the show is back to New York. Last year, I was here with my family for COVID shots, but now there are cars here and plenty of new cars, including electric vehicles. People are walking around, and it's like it just feels so great, you know, to be here.
I know, right? It's like getting back to quote-unquote normal. Having said that, senior U.S. economist for Bloomberg Economics, why do you like to walk that show?
So I am looking to see, like, what the prices are. I'm very interested in what kind of price ranges are presented, and they are expensive, okay? So, and I think we will continue to see prices being pretty high and supported by limited supply and very high demand for motor vehicles. I think we are pretty far away from really significant deceleration in price growth for motor vehicles. We saw a decline in the latest CPI report on used motor vehicles, but I don't think we're anywhere near a substantial series like of declines in terms of car prices. I think we will continue to see that being supported. That gives an opportunity for auto companies to invest in new vehicles, in electric vehicles, and probably make them profitable going forward. So they're expensive, but companies making a lot of money, and they can invest in new technologies.
If anyone listening missed our interview with Keith Naughton earlier about Ford's F-150 Lightning, do check it out. It's the cover of this week's Bloomberg Business Week. What about component shortages, Yelena? Supply chain challenges, inflationary pressures driving prices higher. What's the conversation happening there? What are you seeing on the ground?
So what we see in the data is really like there was a nascent kind of recovery in supply, in assembly lines, and some nascent recovery in inventories, but it was interrupted. It was interrupted by Omicron. It was interrupted by the war in Ukraine, because not only because commodity prices are rising in general, but, for example, Ukraine is a significant supplier of neon gas that is used in production of, semiconductors. So we may see continued supply shortages on the back of the recent developments, and unfortunately, that means that supply will continue to remain, small relative to where the demand is. I think demand is somewhere in 16 to 17 million units annualized, but we may only be able to supply 13 to 15 million. So that means prices will probably continue to be elevated.
Hey, you know, you're over there, the backdrop of, we got another read on retail sales for the month of March. I'm looking at one right through by Romali Smith that says U.S. consumers hang in there despite bigger bite from inflation. Retail sales up 0.5% in March after firmer February results. You're at the car show. You're thinking about the consumer. How would you describe the health of the consumer? And just got about 30 seconds.
Consumer remains healthy. Yes, they had to reallocate some funds towards higher gasoline and prices, but I think overall consumer is still in a good health. Wealth effect from last year, increase in housing prices and equities is there. That will help consumers to shield some of the, from fiscal restraint and so on. So I think we're in a pretty good shape. And I did see the Lightning. It's amazing. So that's one of my favorite vehicles.
I was going to ask you, if you could pick a car to come home with, what would it be? Is it the Lightning? Just quickly.
Yes, absolutely. I'm an F-150 person.
You like the frunk? The trunk in the front?
Yes. It's oh my God, it's amazing. There is a trunk in the front. I was going to sit in there.
I love it. Be good for your family. Hey, listen, take care and have a good week. And our Yelena Shaletyeva.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've talked a little bit about the war in Ukraine, and we know that there's obviously the military aspect of it. There's politics. There's so much at play here. But we've talked a lot, too, about the humanitarian impact and the devastation when it comes to that, Tim, continuing to grow.
Dr. Len Rubenstein is director of the Program on Human Rights, Health, and Conflict at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Rubenstein joins us on the phone from Baltimore. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Rubenstein, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really great to have you. Although, you know, the topic that we are talking about is certainly distressing, I think. It certainly is to me. I do want to get an understanding from you about how we should think about conflict zones. And, you know, when I hear terms like rules of engagement or war crimes, I think to myself, well, you know, isn't it a crime just to do what happens in war anyway? But we are seeing reports of Russia bombing and destroying hospitals. And I'm wondering how we should think about that in the context of human rights, health, and conflict.
The prohibition on attacking hospitals and civilians is very old. The protection of hospitals and patients and health workers goes back more than 150 years. And the reason people talk about war crimes in that context is that those kinds of attacks have been designated as war crimes for a very, very long time, because it's fundamental that even though killing is permitted in war, it's restricted to combatants. You're not supposed to attack non-combatants, whether they're patients in a hospital or civilians living in an apartment house.
Well, and I'm listening to you talk, and I think anybody who's got a clear heart knows that this is not the thing to do, and yet it happens, and we see it over and over again, certainly in our time. What do you think, though, is the grit out there among geopolitical leaders, global leaders, to do something about this, especially if you look at the current case, and do something when it comes to pushback or consequences for Russian President Vladimir Putin and his team?
You're certainly right that this is not a new problem. In wars going back decades and decades, hospitals have been attacked. There were 600 attacks in Syria. Russia attacked hospitals and health workers in Chechnya, and they're not the only ones. The Saudis attacked hospitals in Yemen, and on and on and on. What we hope for now is that this is really the first time the world has really paid the kind of attention it's paying to the enormous number, more than 100 attacks on hospitals in Ukraine. And for once, and it really is for once, there are chances for accountability. The impunity for these attacks has lasted as long as the attacks have taken place. So the question now is, will we bring an end to that?
Well, Dr. Rubenstein, how do we bring an end to that? Because it doesn't seem like the fighting is continuing despite, you know, more than five rounds of sanctions by the UK, the EU, the United States, and a lot of international pressure short of actually the international community going to war with Russia.
You know, it's like the criminal law. People have to know that there are consequences for their actions. And if criminal law is not enforced, people will continue to disobey. And, of course, there will be people who commit crimes regardless of what the law is. But if it's enforced, there's at least a chance, an opportunity, that people will think twice and combatants will think twice before engaging in these kinds of attacks. And it's in the absence of those consequences, or even the realistic prospect of those consequences, that has allowed these attacks to go on and on and on, destroying societies, destroying health systems, leading to deaths both in the moment during the attack and way, way afterwards as health systems collapse, kids go unvaccinated, chronic diseases go untreated, women can't get safe childbirth. So we need to say there has to be a turning point where, and Ukraine, because it's getting so much attention, provides a chance to have that kind of accountability.
Dr. Rubenstein, we only have about 30 seconds left here. Are you disappointed with the UN, though, in not being stronger when it comes to issues like this?
The UN Security Council has a structural problem because the five permanent members have a veto. Until that problem is solved, these powerful states will continue to obstruct enforcement of human rights. So it's a problem of the whole structure of the UN. We're finally having that discussion.
Yeah, and I think it's an important one. We've certainly been having it, I know, in my home, and I know certainly in our newsroom. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Len Rubenstein. He is director of the Program on Human Rights, Health, and Conflict at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Rubenstein joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 10 minutes left in the trading day, getting ready to wrap up this holiday shortened trading week, of course, ahead of the Easter holiday. Hey, and back with us is David Dietz.
David Dietz is managing principal and senior portfolio strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. They've got $11.1 billion in assets under management. David joining us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. David, good to have you back with us. Help us make sense, not just of today's trade, but what we've been seeing lately, because outsized moves from technology and some big moves intraday as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Tim. So I think the key highlight today was the rapid rise in bond yields on that 10-year Treasury got all the way up about 13 basis points to 2.82. You know, we haven't seen a 10-year Treasury that high since 2018. And, of course, what really took it hard were the tech stocks. You know, the mantra there is that they have the longer-dated earnings and therefore are more sensitive to higher interest rates, raising the discounting mechanism to present value those earnings. And so the NASDAQ was down sharply, the Dow and S&P not so much. Why did the interest rates go up? That's what you want to, you know, peel down the onion a little bit. You know, I thought it was the higher than expected import prices announced today kind of took away a little bit of the hope that we had seen peak inflation. Of course, we had Fed speak with John Williams talking about, you know, again, get ready for potentially a 50 basis point hike on May 4th. So those things were not friendly to yields, and stocks fell pretty much accordingly.
All right. So then, you know, we keep talking, David, about, you know, where's the top for yields, right, when it comes to the fixed income and the Treasury trade? Where's the bottom for stocks? Do you have any kind of clear thoughts on that in terms of, you know, is it – and I mean, are you comfortable calling a top or bottom for either of those?
Well, you know, there are no bells rung, of course, at the bottom or the top. So certainly I think traders can take heart with the fact that in the CPI numbers that we got earlier in the week, the headline number was a disaster. But when you strip out that food and energy, and I know we all have to drive and eat, but when you strip that away, the core rate was much lower than expected, which suggests perhaps that there's some mitigation of this price spiral here. And so I think that was a positive. The other thing I liked is that, you know, some of the financials, their results really have been, frankly, quite mixed, adding in loan loss reserves due to Russian losses and potential losses from inflation. But, you know, Citigroup was up today. Morgan Stanley was up today. Goldman wasn't down as much as expected, which suggests that some of these concerns have been priced in, and maybe we're starting to form a little a bottom in some of these sectors.
Retail sales rising half a percentage point in March, despite a bigger bite from inflation. As our Molly Smith writes, a glimmer of optimism that Americans aren't ready to pull back on spending en masse in the face of decades high inflation. Is that also more optimism for you?
Kind of. Obviously, it was good that it wasn't negative, but when you compare the increase in retail sales versus inflation for the month, was it really net of inflation positive? And of course, a lot of the spending was due to the requirement just to spend more on gasoline to keep your car running. So, you know, it was okay. I think what I'm still taking a lot of comfort in is that we have very strong employment metrics. All the people who want jobs have them. We got, of course, weekly unemployment claims today. They're still under 200,000, which is very, very good. So I think as long as consumers have jobs and wages continue to go up, we're going to see pretty strong support out of the consumer.
You know, there's lots of things, David. You know this. We do this here at Bloomberg. There's just all these different market indicators that we try to focus on, whether it's what's going on with the transportation index, the Dow Transports, you know, watching those bank moves. They've been under a lot of pressure despite rates ticking higher, which kind of goes against maybe some of the thinking that we typically have about those big banks. Watching home builders, they're under pressure again, too, as we see mortgage rates climb. What are the key market indicators that you really keep a watch on?
Well, for me, it's really inflation, because with higher inflation, that does reduce, as you're just talking about, consumer spending power. It's going to have a downward effect on corporate margins. And, of course, ultimately, it's going to raise interest rates more and cause the Fed to be more hawkish. So any signs that we're getting past peak inflation is going to be good. I have some optimism there, because I think a lot of it is due to supply side snafus. We know that that pandemic is waning. That should ultimately help things like the ports and so forth. Hopefully China ends some of their lockdown as they get past the pandemic. And of course,
although President Xi coming out and saying that, you know, we're gonna be tough. We know that there's pain and there's going to be an economic impact, but saying that we need to be strict when it comes to the quarantines.
I think he's doing the right things, and my optimism comes that 6 months from now, things could be better. We saw it get better here. Why wouldn't it get better there? And of course, the other key thing to watch is the Russia-Ukraine situation. We saw some ugly headlines today where the N-word came out, nuclear, in response to the idea that Finland and Sweden might drift closer to NATO or join them. That didn't help sentiment, but if we can get past all that, I think that will free up some of those commodities and energy resources, and also help bring down supply side snafus for inflation.
Apart from commodities, David, doesn't it seem like the market in general, at least from an equities perspective, has looked past the conflict?
Well, you know, certainly if we saw, you know, a olive branch extended, I think energy prices would be down 10% before you
right.
finish your
I
coffee
said apart
on Monday
from commodities.
Morning. apart from commodities. Yeah. Well, you know, we're still seeing, you know, we heard from some of the largest banks in the United States about having to set aside money for either losses due to Russia or anticipated losses due to Russia. So I don't know whether that's fully played out there. I do think things would improve, and certainly sentiment would improve if that right. was resolved.
All right, we got to run. Hey, David, thank you so much. Have a good week. And David Dietz, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management, more than $11 billion in assets under management, on the phone from Summit, New Jersey.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.